Welcome to Shorties, a short true crime story.
Happy Tuesday.
Happy Tuesday, my darling ray of sunshine.
Oh, you're getting better at this. Yeah. Getting much better at this. I was just going to say hello, Angel, like I always do. Well, I have a semi-longish story, so should I just jump in?
Totally. Do it.
Today, I'll be covering the tragic death of Katie Autry. And I got most of my information from a docuseries called Southern Gothic. That's on Hulu, and it's really good. On May 4th, 2003, at around 4 a.m., Captain Bob Sanborn received a call at Bowling Green Fire Department. It was a Sunday morning, and there was a fire in one of the dorms on the Western Kentucky campus. At first, when the students heard the alarm sounding, they figured it was just a prank, and they were reluctantly getting out of their beds. Everyone headed down the back stairwell and filed outside. The RA then had to make their rounds, going from room to room, to make sure everyone had woken up and gotten their butts outside. The RA was doing just that when she noticed that room 214 was locked. No one was answering the door when she called. That's when she realized that the smoke was coming from underneath the doorway. The campus police arrived on the scene, and they were able to unlock the door to room 214. The smoke was incredibly thick, and the police weren't equipped to handle it, so they had to sit down and wait until the fire department arrived. One of the WKU officers met the fire department outside and informed the firefighters that the fire was already put out. A few guys from the fire department entered the room and noticed that everything was pitch black. They eyed the room to get an idea of what had happened, and as they're leaving, something caught their eye. It looked as if it was just a pile of clothes that was bunched up on the bed, but then they saw the pile move. It looked as if it was a chest rising and falling, as if they were struggling to take a breath. The young woman's face was covered and wrapped with a nylon stocking. Captain Bob Sanborn said it was like when bank robbers pull a stocking over their face so that they can see but won't be recognizable.
Ugh.
They removed the stocking slowly from her face, and from what they could see, she had been terribly beaten. Her face was completely battered, and she had small puncture wounds all over her neck. And the wounds were small and round, about the size of a pencil or pen, and it appeared that she had also been strangled. The students watched as the firefighters carried 18-year-old Katie Autry out of the building. One of the firefighters looked at the crowd of students and said, "If you're a praying person, then right now is the time to pray." Katie was born in Rosine, Kentucky on June 10th, 1984, making her a Gemini. Rosine is as tiny as it gets, as of 2020, at a population of only 110 people. Katie had one sister named Lisa. Oh my God. It's Lisa. Like, what? She had one sister named Lisa.
And it's Lisa.
It's Lisa. What's wrong with me? And the two girls were inseparable with their cousin Barbie. They dreamed of opening a salon one day where they could do makeup and hair and nails. Katie was put into foster care around middle school when her mom got sick. Luckily, her foster parents were great people, and they were supportive of Katie and Lisa maintaining a relationship with their biological family. Katie was sunshine in human form. Her energy and spirit was contagious, and it was impossible to be in a bad mood around her. Her cousin Johnny said it almost seemed like she never had a bad day. She was a cheerleader all through high school, which seemed like a fitting sport for someone like her. She had applied to a bunch of colleges, but committed to WKU, a college that was only an hour away from her hometown. She was incredibly family-oriented, so choosing a campus that was so close meant that she'd have her own autonomy, but she would still get to see her family as much as she wanted. Katie met a fellow student named Howard the very first week of school. They were in the same dorm and became quick friends. He described her as shy and quiet until you really got to know her. Then she was lively and talkative and always wanted to be around you. Katie became really close friends with a girl named Danica, and she ended up moving into her dorm. They were inseparable and were never seen without each other. Her freshman year was going really well, and she was building her own little community at WKU. A week before summer break began, she was carried out by firefighters from her dorm room, room 214. Katie was being loaded into an ambulance when they heard her say, "Take me home." Even though she was covered in horrific third and fourth degree burns, she was still alive. She was rushed to Bowling Green Medical Center. Meanwhile, police treated her dorm room as a crime scene. It was evident that someone had tried to kill Katie Autry. Officers saw that someone had tied a wet rag over the sprinkler head to prevent it from putting out the fire, but enough water was able to escape and the fire was put out. Arson investigators took a look around the room to figure out where the fire originated. It appeared that the fire was started on Katie's bed. Her mattress was burned all the way through, and a crumpled up blanket was torched. They were able to determine that the fire originated on Katie herself while she was lying on the bed. Danica's side of the room did not catch fire. Arson investigators knew it would be difficult to collect evidence because not only had her room caught fire, water had drenched everything as well. They located a can of hairspray that they believed could have been used to accelerate the fire. It appeared that Katie had been raped, beaten, and stabbed, and then set on fire so that any evidence would be destroyed. Katie's family had been alerted to the accident, and they headed straight to Bowling Green Medical Center. When the family arrived, the nurses immediately guided them into the quiet room. The doctor walked inside and informed them of what had happened to Katie and that she was going to be airlifted to Nashville. He also made it clear that she would probably not survive the trip to Nashville due to the severity of her injuries. She was taken to Vanderbilt Burn Unit and put into a medically induced coma. After 2 days, the medical staff wanted to reduce the sedation, and her mom, sister, and cousin were in the room with her. When she was regaining consciousness, she started moving her head and swinging her arms and hands around like she was fighting to defend herself.
Oh.
It was unclear if she was reacting this way because of the severe pain and not understanding what was happening to her, or if she still thought that she was in the dorm room fighting for her life. It was crucial to figure out exactly what Katie did the night of her attack, where she was, who she was with, and what she was doing. Like most dorm buildings, you had to have a student ID to get inside, or you would have to have an ID to show to a guard to be able to access the elevators or stairs up to the rooms. In this particular dorm building, you had to show your student ID card to the attendant at the front desk, and then you were allowed to go through. At 1 or 1:30 a.m. on May 4th, Katie was seen by the female attendant entering the building by herself. Katie smiled and waved at the girl at the front desk. She was wearing blue jeans and a burgundy jacket. Katie walked straight up to her room. Katie's roommate, Danica, was nowhere to be found. Detectives started asking the students gathered outside if they knew where she was. One girl said that Danica was staying at a friend's house that night. The girl called Danica and informed the detective that she was headed over right away. When Danica went into the police station, she was in tears. She told detectives that she and Katie had been at a frat party the night before, specifically a Pi Kappa Alpha, also known as a Pike party. It was Kentucky Derby weekend, which was a big deal in the South, especially Kentucky. There were a lot of parties that weekend, and everyone was drinking a lot. Katie's boyfriend Maurice was at the party with the girls. He played football for WKU. He had quite the reputation with the ladies. Katie was in love with Maurice and very loyal to him, but it turned out that he was actually seeing quite a few other women behind her back.
Ugh.
Great.
Cool. Very cool.
Cool. That never happens.
I feel like we can't find a single story where there's not some type of cheating involved.
Yeah, it's actually nearly impossible, which is adding to my cynicism. Katie and Maurice got into a fight at the party that night, and she was asked to leave by one of the guys there. There were frat pledges that were in charge of being the designated drivers that night, and according to Danica, she took the driver aside and asked him to get her home safely. She mentioned that his name was Ryan. Danica had called Katie around 2:30 a.m. just to make sure that she had gotten home safely, and Katie told Danica that she was lying in bed and that she felt sick. Suddenly, Danica heard someone walk into Katie's room in the background. Katie then said, "I'm scared. There's this guy in our room and I don't know who he is." Danica told Katie to hand him the phone so that she could talk to him. She asked him who he was, and he told her that he was the guy that drove her home from the party. He said, "Don't worry, I'll take good care of her." Danica said that she heard another voice in the background before they hung up the call. I'm trying not to judge because she is young, but Danica didn't do anything about this. She didn't go to the dorm to check on Katie or notify anyone that there were strange men in their room.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah, it's bad.
Is she drunk too? I'm sure
she's probably drunk, but it's like young. We've all been tipsy, and if we heard this, we would know to call somebody. Now investigators are potentially looking for two males that might have done this to Katie. Detectives brought in Katie's boyfriend Maurice for questioning. Maurice was visibly upset, and he told him that Katie had asked him to go home with her, and he had said no.
Oh,
he had actually gone home with another girl that night.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. Maurice gave the detectives her name and number, and his alibi checked out. Next step was locating and interviewing the driver that night, a young man named Ryan. When authorities showed up at the frat house, Ryan wasn't there. They asked a couple of the frat guys if they had seen anything strange that night. A couple of them noted that there was a man sitting inside Ryan's truck the entire time that the party was going on. So when Katie got in, Ryan wasn't the only man in there. Ryan told the authorities that he simply dropped her off at her dorm building and then drove away. He said he didn't follow her inside, and he definitely didn't talk to Danica on the phone that night. He was questioned about the mysterious man that had been in his truck. He told authorities that he was just a guy from his hometown named Steven Souls. According to Ryan, Steven got too drunk at the party and needed to lay down, so he spent most of his time at the party in the back seat. Steven was not a student at WKU. He was just there for the Kentucky Derby parties. During the drive to Katie's dorm, Steven got sick. Katie teased him about it, and when she got out of the truck, she said, "See you later, sick boy. Hope you get to feeling better soon." And according to Katie's family, that was very much something that she would say.
Seems so innocent.
I know,
too.
It's so like cute. See you later, sick boy.
Yeah.
Ryan then told the authorities that they were driving away from the dorm building when Steven suddenly asked to get out. Ryan didn't question why, so he let him out of the truck and went home to play video games with his roommate. His alibi checked out. The detectives were very curious about who this Steven guy was and why he wanted to get out of the truck that night. They looked him up and saw that he had been arrested before, but for nothing violent. He was 20 years old and originally from Scottsville, Kentucky. They looked everywhere for Steven, but it was like he disappeared. On May 7th, Katie's cousin Barbie called up Katie's mom. She wanted to see how she was doing. Katie's mom said that the swelling was subsiding, so she was starting to look like herself again. She was hopeful that Katie was going to be okay. The relief didn't last long, because by the time Barbie got to the hospital to visit, Katie's swelling had returned. The doctors told her family that they didn't think Katie would pull through. Barbie said, "I just remember praying for God to save her because I didn't want to live in a world where Katie wasn't there." That night, a candlelit vigil was held on campus for Katie. Over 100 people showed up and said prayers for her. Meanwhile, Katie's family sang "My Girl" to her as she passed away at the hospital. An autopsy confirmed that she died as a result of her burn injuries. Detective Pickett knew he had to take a different approach to this case so that he could get justice for Katie and her family. Southern hospitality is a real thing in Kentucky, so he drove over to the family home of Steven Souls and talked to his family. He told Steven's brother that he's not a hard guy to get along with, and it would be in Steven's best interest to talk to him immediately. It was important for Detective Pickett to build a rapport with the brother, and he told him that he wasn't going to up and arrest him when he saw him. He just wanted to talk. As Detective Pickett was leaving, his brother said, "If I find him, I'll have him call you." That evening, Steven was at the police station. He came in voluntarily and agreed to an interview. He said that he had had sex with Katie Autry that night, but insisted that he didn't hurt her. He confirmed what Ryan said about the party and being drunk in the truck. He said that Katie did get out of the truck and walk to her dorm room. He also said that he wanted to get out of the car to make sure that she made it up to her room okay. Katie didn't see that he had gotten out of the truck and followed her. When she opened the door, he snuck in right behind her. Steven said that he went up to her room and talked to Katie's friend on the phone around 2:30 a.m. For hours, Steven sat in that room being questioned with his head in his hands, gently rocking back and forth while repeating, "I didn't hurt that girl." However, he admitted to knowing who did. According to Steven, he was hanging out with Katie when his friend, Lucas Goodrum, called to ask where he was. Steven and Lucas had known each other for a while. Lucas was 21. They had gone to high school together back in Scottsville. Steven said that the next thing he knew, Lucas was at the door of her dorm room. And my brain starts spinning because I'm like, did you tell him where she lived? How did he get inside the building? How did he know what room she was in?
Obviously, it's not the next thing I know.
Yeah,
it's,
like, why are you acting like you weren't expecting him there when you gave him all of the specifics of where you guys were?
Yeah.
He said that Lucas walked in and could tell that he and Katie had had sex. And according to Steven, he wanted to get some too, but she wasn't down with it.
Ew.
Disgusting. Lucas instantly gets violent. He pushed Katie onto the bed. He sexually assaulted her and proceeded to beat her. while Steven stood there doing nothing. He said that he was scared that Lucas would do something to him if he were to interfere. Steven said that Lucas started spraying her with hairspray, and that's when Steven left. He insisted that Lucas set her on fire after he left. This explained the two voices that Danica heard on the phone. Investigators seemed to buy Steven's story, and after taking a DNA sample, they release him. They have to gather more evidence before they can arrest him. Meanwhile, the students on campus are frightened. A fellow student had been sexually assaulted and burned alive in their own dorm room, and the females on campus feared that they were next. Some WKU students recalled that all of the girls would travel in groups, and the male students would escort them to their cars and dorms. Arrests hadn't been made, and no one felt safe. The Bowling Green Police Department got in contact with the Scottsville Police Department to see if they knew anything about Lucas Goodrum. They were fully aware of who Lucas was because they had had quite a few run-ins with him throughout the years. And crazy enough, Scottsdale PD had gotten a domestic violence report on Lucas just hours before Katie had been attacked.
Hours before?
Just hours before. Apparently that night, Lucas and his teenage girlfriend had gotten into a fight, and at one point he slapped her. She stated that he hit her twice in the face with a cell phone. That escalated into Lucas punching her and holding her down in her car so that she couldn't get away. The teenage girl called the police, who informed her that since she was a minor, she would need a signature from her parents to issue an arrest warrant. What? No warrant was issued.
What?
Didn't know that was a thing. 6 days after Katie Autry's body was found, police were able to locate Lucas Goodrum. When he was brought in, he thought he was there because of the attack against the teenage girl the same night. Like,
No, the other woman
that you attacked.
Yeah.
During questioning, he admitted to running into Katie at the frat party that night. He insisted that Katie flirtatiously rubbed his stomach with her hand as she walked by, but that's the only interaction that he had with her. He didn't go to her dorm room, and he definitely didn't murder her. Lucas insisted that the police had the wrong guy, and when detectives told him what Steven said, he called him a liar, said he's just always been a liar. They got absolutely nothing out of him during that interview, but based off Steven's testimony, Lucas was arrested for murder, rape, assault, and arson. DNA and fingerprints were taken and sent to the lab so that specialists could compare Lucas's fingerprints to those found on the scene. It took 3 months for the Kentucky State Police Crime Lab to provide the results. DNA taken from the crime scene matched the samples of only one person, and that man was Steven Soles.
Oh.
There was absolutely no DNA or physical evidence that could place Lucas Goodrum at the scene of the murder.
No way.
Steven Soles was arrested and taken into custody. He took a plea deal to avoid the death penalty, and the agreement was that he would plead guilty and testify against Lucas. Lucas Goodrum's murder trial began in March of 2005. This was almost 2 years after Katie had been murdered. When Steven was on the stand, he said that he had been in her dorm room when Lucas showed up. He said that Lucas knocked on the door and walked right in. Steven stated that Lucas told Katie, "You're going to give me some of that whether you want to or not." Then Katie proceeded to slap him. Lucas grabbed her face with his hand and shoved her into the wall. Steven recalled that Katie was going in and out of consciousness during her attack, before Lucas stabbed Katie multiple times in the neck. Steven stood there in horror and tried to leave. Lucas told him that if he didn't shut up, he'd murder him and his family. And this is when Steven's story changed significantly. When he first talked to the police, he said that he got scared and left the dorm room. Now he's saying that Lucas forced him to do all the things that he had just done to Katie to cover it up. He said he did in fact rape her, but only because Lucas made him do it. This is a ridiculous accusation. I shouldn't even have to say that.
Yeah.
Because samples taken from the crime scene clearly show that one man had assaulted her. If Lucas had assaulted her prior, his DNA would have been there too. And like, I hate to be graphic, but the sperm of one person does not cancel out the sperm of another. It would both be present.
Yeah.
Steven then made a shocking statement. He said that he didn't leave the dorm room after that. He said that he took the hairspray and lighter and continued to spray Katie until she was burnt to the bone. But once again, only because Lucas told him to. The majority of the hairspray was directed toward her genitals so that the semen would be destroyed. Now it was Lucas Goodrum's time to take the stand. he stated that he was at his parents' house at the time of the fire. And according to Lucas's father and stepmother, he was home in Scottsville by the time the fire alarms were going off. But like, parents can't be your alibi. They're going to cover it up. Like, even if, I mean, I don't know. I actually think my parents would tell the truth. I think that their conscience couldn't handle that.
Sure.
But like, I don't trust all parents.
Yeah. There was, it's sort of like trusting the spouse being like, no, he was with me in bed all night.
Yeah. He was by my side. It's like, no, that's not the case. And there's no proof that he was home. It was just his father's word. And like, also, why did he go to his parents' house after partying all night when he didn't even live with them?
Oh, he didn't?
No. It's like, what's the point of that?
Oh, I assumed he lived with at home.
Mm-mm.
Okay, yeah.
Even weirder.
Yeah.
Lucas's roommates admitted that he was exhibiting some very bizarre behavior in the days following the murder. They recalled that he slept in the closet instead of his bed. That's not normal.
No.
He kept talking about leaving for Florida and leaving everything, including his car, behind. These are the words and actions of a guilty man.
Yeah.
After 2.5 hours of deliberation, the jury found Lucas Goodrum innocent of the murder of Katie Autry. There was no physical evidence placing him at the scene, and he was able to walk free. He was living in Texas for a while, but his current whereabouts are unknown. Stephen Soles was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. He is currently serving his sentence at the Luther Luckett Correctional Complex in LaGrange. A man named Richard Mueller claimed that he and Lucas Goodrum were in jail at the same time when he was in for a misdemeanor assault charge. He said that they were in the Warren County Regional Jail medical cell recovering from injuries that he had sustained when Lucas opened up to Richard about what had happened. He told Richard that he was one of the men who had sexually assaulted and beaten Katie Autry. He said a black man had been there with him. Richard didn't understand why Lucas was telling him this, and even said, "This is none of my business. I don't want to hear it." Richard said that 6 other people had been in the cell with him at the time, and moments after stating that he had done it, Lucas told everyone in the cell that he actually wasn't there.
Okay.
Yeah, like you. According to a few other inmates, Lucas had told them that he thought Katie was worthless and no one would care about her death because she was poor. Records show that Lucas Goodrum was in fact in the medical cell from December 30th to January 5th, and Richard Mueller had been in the medical cell from December 28th to January 5th. So there is overlap there.
Okay.
There is no way of knowing if this is true, but Richard Mueller still stands behind what he told detectives during the voluntary interview. Admittedly, I fell into the Reddit black hole, and a good portion of the comments are about the blatant racism during the trial and sentencing. Apparently, Lucas Goodrum is the stepson of Cal Turner, the man who founded Dollar General. So not only is he a white man, he had the money to pay for better legal representation.
Mm-hmm.
The talk around campus at the time was that Lucas actually was the main aggressor, but the lack of evidence due to reckless behavior by campus police and an alibi that was confirmed by his own parents made it so that everything was pinned on Stephen Soles, an African-American man. Unfortunately, we will never know if Lucas had any involvement or if Stephen was simply lying to cover up the crimes that he had committed. Even though one individual was sentenced to life in prison, I can't help but think that another individual got away with a horrific murder. Katie and her family deserve justice, and I do not believe that justice was served. And that is the story of Katie Autry.
Wow, you told that so well, but I'm so baffled because obviously Lucas was involved in some capacity, but how is there zero physical evidence placing him there?
I mean, okay, so not to be...
How is that possible?
Not to be really graphic, because I've thought about this a lot. So if most of the hairspray was targeted toward her genitals...
Yeah.
If there is... I know this is gross and graphic, but if he had finished externally...
Okay.
And then she was burned... You know, there is a chance of that even being the case, because there is no way of knowing physically if you were penetrated by one or two people.
Yeah. True.
All we know is
there
the
was
semen.
Penetration.
There was penetration. Yeah. So there is always that that chance that he finished externally and Stephen did not.
Yeah.
And so there was only evidence of one person being there.
Yeah.
But the fact that Danica heard two people.
I know. That's unmistakable. You don't hear two voices that aren't there.
No, absolutely not. So I think if that wasn't there, I would have a tendency to even think that probably Stephen was lying and trying to pin it on this guy that he knew was in and out of jail anyways.
Yeah.
And an aggressive person that was, you know, beating his girlfriend, his underage girlfriend. But the fact that she heard two voices in my head solidifies that.
And also just like in such a cliche way, like the little white rich boy goes to his daddy's house at 2 a.m. and is like,
I was here all night. Okay. I was here all night. Yeah.
I know. Like, that makes so much more sense knowing like his family background too.
And also, if Lucas hadn't had any involvement, why is he later arrested for, you know, a misdemeanor, Unrelated, assault charge? He's in a cell and he's talking about how he was in fact responsible for part of it.
Yeah.
A black guy did a little bit, but he did a little bit.
Yeah.
And then saying that she's worthless because she's poor.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's sick.
He's for sure
involved
in some capacity. But
with that being said, it's like, I think all people involved should be charged, but Stephen Soles, we do know, was involved. And so it's not like he's wrongfully serving time. He just shouldn't be the only one serving time.
Yeah. It just shouldn't. Just, yeah.
Yes. Yes. What you just said. Ditto.
Yes.
Well,
thank you for telling that story. You did a really good job telling it.
Well, thanks, girl. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right. Love you.
I love you.
Bye.
Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you enjoy listening. We owe everything to the many journalists, authors, filmmakers, psychiatrists, and psychologists whose extensive work and expertise we pulled from to share this episode with you. To view detailed source material, as well as content from today, please visit us on Instagram and TikTok at Shorty's Podcast. We really love doing this show, and if you'd like to help with the continued creation of it, you can support by donating to our Patreon, patreon.com/shortiespodcast. This episode was hosted by Ashley Brumley Johnson and Anna Katharina.